saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
There's just like this real visceral connection to place. I'd have to say it wasn't just a connection to place, but a connection of solidarity and sympathy for the poor and disadvantaged.
Ever since I could remember, I'd wished I'd been lucky enough to be alive at a great time when something big was going on, like the crucifixion. And suddenly I realized I was.
Henry Ford's General Secretary, Ernest Liebold, who was said to have his own Gestapo within the Ford Motor Company. Smith himself was employed by Ford, rooting out communists and labor unions.
I stand here today under great stress because I dare, as do you, all of you, to fight for peace and for a decent life for all men, women, and children.
Irene Perkiw grew up a coal miner's daughter in the mountains of Lincoln County, West Virginia. She was a coal miner's wife, a mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. But much of her life was spent as a musician activist, taking part in writing songs for many of the major union strikes over the past 50 years. Friday's folklore editor Saul Schneiderman remembers Elaine on today's show. David Gariff is a senior lecturer at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and an adjunct professor of art history at the Catholic University of America. He's led labor art tours for the D.C. Labor Fest for the past few years, showing us how work and workers are represented in many works of art. Today, he tells the story of how artist Ben Shahn was inspired by the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian immigrant anarchists wrongly convicted of murder and executed during an earlier spasm of anti-immigrant fervor in the United States in the 1920s. From the Tales of the Reuther Library podcast, When It Happened Here, Michigan and the Transnational Development of American Fascism. Selena Catalano-Crum explains how American fascism developed and thrived in Michigan from the 1920s through the 1940s and, arguably, up through the present day. And on this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about the voice of an era, Paul Robeson. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show.
This is Saul Schneiderman, the editor of Friday's Labor Folklore newsletter. COVID-19 has taken the lives of over 300 West Virginians, and on September 2nd, the state lost one of its most powerful and vocal social activists and musicians. Caitlin Tan of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reported that Elaine Perkiw passed away in Ranger, West Virginia at 71 years old. Elaine Perkiw grew up a coal miner's daughter in the mountains of Lincoln County. She was a coal miner's wife, a mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. But much of her life was spent as a musician activist, taking part and writing songs for many of the major union strikes over the past 50 years. Perkiw was internationally known. One of her performances was featured in a PBS documentary. She played in the 2003 Smithsonian Folklife Festival, and she's included in a folklife collection at the Library of Congress. But all of her inspiration came from the Mountain State. I use the term hillbilly as a compliment, said Rick Wilson, a native West Virginian who works with the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker social justice group. She's hardcore Southern West Virginia, and West Virginians, you know, are almost tribal in some ways. There's just like this real visceral connection to place. I'd have to say it wasn't just a connection to place, but a connection of solidarity and sympathy for the poor and disadvantaged, he said. Wilson and Perkiw were friends for over 30 years, first meeting at a coal workers' strike and later bonding over their love of music. Her song, One Day More, is about the 1990-92 Ravenswood lockout, where nearly 2,000 United Steelworkers Union members demanded safer working conditions. It became one of her most famous songs, featured in the 2006 Smithsonian Folkways Recordings album, Classic Labor Songs. The song is about union workers outlasting companies by holding out one day more. If the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. In Appalachia, there's a tradition of women writing and singing songs of protest. Aunt Molly Jackson, Sarah Ogan Gunning, Hazel Dickens, and now Elaine Perkey. These voices from the mountains inspire us to fight one day more for a better and a more just world. Friday's Labor Folklore is a free weekly email newsletter. Send an email and say subscribe me to fridaysfolklore@gmail.com.
We don't need your pity, we just need your helping hand to fight one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. One day more, one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. We've got to change the way things are, make people understand. Our working class is being denied the rights of a free man. Our government lets criminals run free to steal again. Then takes the jobs of honest working women and men. We'll fight one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. If the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. Let's change the laws, remove the flaws, and start all over new. Demand our rights, take back our land, spread freedom through and through. Vote the scabs out of the White House, vote union brothers in. Then the feds can't ever take us off in a ball and chains again. We'll fight one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more, one day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more, one day more, people let me tell you what we're fighting for. Don't you understand? And you won't need our pity, you'll just need our helping hands to fight one day more, if the companies hold out 20 years, we can hold out one day more, one day more, if the companies hold out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more.
David Gariff is a senior lecturer at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and an adjunct professor of art history at the Catholic University of America. He's led labor art tours for the D.C. Labor Fest for the past few years, showing us how work and workers are represented in many works of art. Today, he tells the story of how artist Ben Shahn was inspired by the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian immigrant anarchists wrongly convicted of murder and executed during an earlier spasm of anti-immigrant fervor in the United States in the 1920s.
Justice denied. Ben Shahn and the case of Sacco and Vanzetti. Quote, "If it had not been for these things, I might have lived out my life talking at street corners to scorning men. I might have died, unmarked, unknown, a failure. Now we are not a failure. This is our career and our triumph. Never in our full life could we hope to do such work for tolerance, for justice, for man's understanding of man, as now we do by accident. Our words, our lives, our pains, nothing. The taking of our lives, lives of a good shoemaker and a poor fish peddler all, that last moment belongs to us. That agony is our triumph. Unquote. Bartolomeo Vanzetti. Bartolomeo Vanzetti was born on June 11, 1888, in Villa Faleto in the province of Cuneo in the region of Piedmont. Niccolo Sacco was born on April 22, 1891, in Torre Maggiore in the province of Foggia in the region of Apulia. Sacco and his brother Sabino emigrated to America in April 1908, arriving in Boston and proceeding immediately to Milford, Massachusetts. Bartolomeo Vanzetti, traveling alone, arrived in New York in June of the same year. He too soon moved on, seeking work in various cities in Connecticut and Massachusetts. Sacco eventually found employment as a skilled worker in a shoe factory in Milford, where he married in 1917 and had a son and daughter. Vanzetti never married, worked at several low-paying jobs, ultimately earning a living as an itinerant fish peddler. The two men did not meet until May 1917 in Boston, during a meeting of the anarchist followers of Luigi Galliani. From that point forward, their lives and fates would be inexorably intertwined. The arrest, trial, and executions of Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti occurred at a time of great social and political upheaval in the United States. World War I and the Russian Revolution contributed to anti-immigrant sentiment. Prejudice was particularly strong against Italian Americans as newcomers who were believed to espouse radical ideas of anarchism, communism, or socialism. Sacco's and Vanzetti's status as Italian immigrants and their anarchist sympathies led to their arrest for armed robbery and murder in South Braintree, Massachusetts, on circumstantial evidence. Their trials took place in an atmosphere of anti-Italian American anger and scorn. On July 14, 1921, the jury convicted both men. Despite worldwide protests and appeals for clemency, the two men were executed in the electric chair at midnight between August 22nd and 23rd, 1927. The deaths of Sacco and Vanzetti continued to fuel protests, demonstrations, and commemorations long after their executions. The painter Ben Shahn was among the many artists to express his outrage at the fate of the two Italian immigrants. He likened their trial and deaths to the Passion of Christ. In 1931-32, several years after Sacco's and Vanzetti's death, Shahn produced a series of 23 gouaches illustrating what he called the Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti. Shahn is quoted as saying, quote, "Ever since I could remember, I'd wished I'd been lucky enough to be alive at a great time, when something big was going on, like the crucifixion. And suddenly I realized I was. Here I was, living through another crucifixion. Here was something to paint." Unquote. Shahn continued to return to the theme of Sacco and Vanzetti as martyrs, punished for sins they did not commit, long after the actual events of the 1920s. On August 23, 1977, the 50th anniversary of the executions, Governor Michael S. Dukakis proclaimed Niccolo Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti Memorial Day. The governor issued a proclamation, in both English and Italian, stating that, quote, "The atmosphere of their trial and appeals was permeated by prejudice against foreigners and hostility toward unorthodox political views, unquote. It went on to declare, quote, that any stigma and disgrace should be forever removed from the names of Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti and from the names of their families and descendants.
David Gariff reading Justice Denied, Ben Shahn and the Case of Sacco and Vanzetti, which appears in the October 2020 issue of La Gazzetta Italiana. David is a senior lecturer at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., and an adjunct professor of art history at the Catholic University of America.
Welcome to Tales from the Reuther, a podcast coming to you from the Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State University in the heart of Detroit, Michigan. I am Dan Galadner, your host, and alongside me on the internet connection is my co-host, Troy Eller English. Now, on this episode, we talked with Solana Crum, who wrote an article in the Michigan Historical Review titled, When It Happened Here, Michigan and the Transnational Development of American Fascism, 1920 to 1945. Crum is a recent graduate from the London School of Economics and Political Science in a dual degree program in International World History with Columbia University and was summa cum laude from Albion College with a BA in History and Political Science. And in this article, she lays out the evolution of American fascism and the ties with the German Nazis. She talks about the anti-Semitic writings of Henry Ford and how his writings influenced Hitler, and then takes us all the way to the end of World War II and how these American fascists evolved into the Red Scare groups of the 1950s and 60s, that evolved finally into the American Nazis of the 1970s. At this point, I was going to go on a little rant comparing a scene in the movie The Best Years of Our Lives, where there was a fight scene in the soda shop about fighting the wrong enemy, and the comparison of today's language is used by some people today. But I will not, because we were told many years ago not to get too political. So I leave it up to you folks. This is a timely, important conversation about how it did happen here and is happening here. Selena, thank you very much for joining Tales from the Reuther. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us. So before we get into the heart of your research, could you please explain what is American fascism?
Okay, so I argue that American fascism was a hybrid and transnational ideology constructed by right-wing extremists in the U.S. and Europe that combined traditional American nativism, and I define that simply as anti-immigrant sentiment, and that's something that's existed in the United States since its founding. So this combined with a newly emerging European fascism, which I define as espousing nationalism, anti-communism, superiority of race, authority of a strong leader, violent paramilitary methods, and reliance on patriotic rituals. And I argue that there were different categories of American fascists. We can't think of them just as a loud-mouthed dictator. But in this country, they were industrialists, anti-communist, crusading clergymen, militarized secret societies, and immigrant veterans and explicitly fascist groups. And I think there have been a few different episodes of American fascism. One occurred between the 1920s and 1940s, concurrently with European fascism. And that's the one I focus on in my research and writing. Another occurred, one in the 1960s and one in the 1990s, as neo-Nazi groups emerged. And then some argue that another one is developing right now, with the alt-right and white supremacist groups proliferating throughout the United States.
So let's go back to this transnational ideology that you are talking about. Specifically, the beginning of the early 1920s, you had your industrialist, Henry Ford, writing materials that began influencing those in Germany.
Right.
Then back again, right?
And yes.
It kind of like turned over. Can you expand on what was happening in the U.S. in the 1920s, which developed of a fascist parties, and how this influence was going back and forth, please?
Yeah. So we typically think of the post-World War I era as a return to normalcy in the U.S., a retreat from the world stage, and a breeding ground of isolationism. In fact, I mean, it was that, but it was also during this period that both the European and American fascist movements were created. And in both cases, it was because of the establishment of a transnational network of ideological exchange between none other than Henry Ford and Adolf Hitler. It all started with Henry Ford, who from 1920 to 1921 began publishing anti-Semitic articles in the Dearborn Independent. And this all stemmed from he had a bad experience with a loan and started blaming the Jewish people. So these articles were compiled and released under the heading The International Jew. So what really on the surface was a Ford Motor Company newsletter became combined into this publication all about the so-called Jewish plot of internationalism. And he propagated what became the basic tenets of anti-Semitism. I mean, Hitler's arguments are identical. Mm-hmm. So for that first half of the 20s, the direction of that international exchange was going west to east towards Germany. Mm-hmm. They were trying to build their movement in Germany. But I think this was reversed in the mid-1920s when Italian and German Americans began establishing fascist groups in their new homeland. So the biggest explicitly Nazi group was the Teutonic National Socialist Association, known as the Teutonium, and that was founded in Chicago in 1924. The branch in Detroit was one of the first to follow, and it claimed to be the oldest and largest Nazi group in America. Mm-hmm. And its activities, like the Italian fascist groups, had this weird combination of patriotic American holiday celebrations, like Labor Day, but then they also had iconic Nazi rituals commemorating Hitler's birthday. So the 1920s saw this formation of the transnational ideological network that built both American fascism and German National Socialism.
So we enter the 1930s, Great Depression rocks the world. It seems that in Europe, the European fascism in Germany takes hold very quickly with redefining the economy and unemployment drops quickly. Right. But in America, it's slow. It seems to help develop this American fascism. What kind of groups and individuals developed and gained strength throughout the Great Depression?
Right. So Hitler comes to power and quickly has economic and political success, which crystallized support for the German National Socialist Party in Germany among German-American people in the U.S. The extremists among them started looking to European fascist solutions for American problems. This seemed like the ideal time to increase efforts to bring Nazis into America. So a number of independent grassroots organizations formed, and one was called Der Bund der Freunde des Neuen Deutschlands, or the Bund of the Friends of the New Germany. And that's what they called Hitler's Germany, was the New Germany. Mm-hmm. So the Teutonia, which was dissolved by Hitler, was resurrected within this group. It shared the same leaders. And in fact, it was founded by a Detroit Teutonia member and Ford employee, along with a new member named Fritz Kuhn, another Ford employee, and he became the Detroit branch leader, and by 1936 assumed national leadership of the whole organization, and he renamed it the German-American Bund, and he became America's Führer. Mm-hmm. So this peculiar combination of German Nazi and American rituals were what I think are the roots of what became a united fascist front against the crisis of Jewish communism. But while they went through this Nazification process, they sought to Americanize their message as well and diversify their base. So during this early time of the 1930s, the German-American National Socialist Movement simultaneously became explicitly Nazi, but also Americanized.
Wow, it is kind of creepy, this combination of American traditional democracy mixed in with the fascist mm-hmm. Nazi propaganda. So what kind of individuals or other groups were percolating along with this?
One of these groups was a northern offshoot of the KKK called the Black Legion. And this was an armed nativist secret society formed in Ohio, but very prevalent in Michigan. And like the KKK, Black Legion members were required to be white, Gentile Protestants. But in other significant ways, the Black Legion resembled the Nazi SA more than the KKK. So first it was militarized in terms of organization. It was organized according to military rank and included national and local death squads or strong arm squads, similar to the SA. Second, it emphasized violence in its tactics and was revolutionary in its goals. So members regularly held target practice, were involved in multiple murders, arsons, beatings, lynchings. They amassed arms and ammunition in preparation for taking over government agencies and arsenals, and they had a national call to action word, Lixto. And their leader said that their code demanded that members work unceasingly toward the extermination of the Jewish people and attempt to overthrow the present form of government, placing in its stead a dictatorship akin to that in Italy and Germany. Another American right-wing extremist organization was not as revolutionary or violent, but it emerged at the same time, and it became central to this United Fascist Front. And this was the radio priest, Father Charles Coughlin, pastor of the Shrine of the Little Flower in Royal Oak. And he founded the National Union for Social Justice, which had a weekly magazine by the same name, Social Justice. And their principles were having a living wage for workers, nationalization of public resources, a national bank, wartime conscription of wealth and men. But like the Nazi Party, it described itself as a mass national workers' party. Eventually, he developed into an apologist, an outright admirer of European fascists,
right,
and started applying the fascist ideology to the American situation.
There's a story that is folklore within the American Federation of Teachers. One of their presidents, Albert Shanker, was in New York as a kid, and every Sunday after Coughlin's address, if he was outside, he would try to avoid to be outside. So if he was caught outside, he was in a mixed neighborhood, and the Irish kids would come and try to beat him up for, tall, lanky Jewish kid.
So, the National Committee of America First was founded in Chicago in September 1940. Henry Ford was a member, and Coughlin praised Ford's neutrality as a realistic recognition that Germany will be on top for years to come, he said. So both immigrant and Native American fascists saw the Second World War as a rising tide of internationalism that was increasingly threatening to expose and warrant investigations into their formation of a new ideology. So the German-American Bund attempted to counteract this by appealing more to Americanism. So the most iconic example of this is the rally at Madison Square Garden in honor of George Washington on February 20th, 1939. And this was also a great example of the Bund's method of forging a united front with Native American fascists. So this rally was called a mass demonstration for true Americanism and combined the typical Nazi practices of having stormtroopers beat a Jewish anti-Nazi demonstrator. They were saluting swastika flags. They were calling out for Gentile Americanism, and all under the gaze of this colossal portrait of George Washington. So America's Führer, Fritz Kuhn, addressed this 20,000-person crowd, and he characterized the German-American Nazi movement as a purely American outgrowth of the Founding Fathers and called for a socially just, white, Gentile-ruled United States. He wanted to outlaw the Communist Party. He wanted to cease the influx of political refugees and return government to the policies of George Washington, namely aloofness from foreign entanglements. That one night is just the perfect example of what was going on and how serious they were taking it right before America entered the war.
So it was a definite threat there, if you can pack in Madison Square Garden for something like this. But here we go. The United States enters the war, and things definitely have to shift for these American fascists. But as you point out in your paper, they didn't really dissolve that quickly. They just morphed into something else. What happened to them?
When America enters the war, the American fascists, both immigrant and native, they're facing higher scrutiny because there are investigatory committees and organizations like the FBI looking into subversive fascist activity. Coughlin had a willingness to support this United Fascist Front in public word and private deed, and that earned him the praise of German and Italian fascists in Europe. But anti-fascists at home labeled him in social justice mouthpieces of foreign propaganda, which resulted in Coughlin repeatedly getting banned from broadcasting. He kind of fizzled out following that. Smith himself maintained active leadership of his committee of 1 million. He had the most endurance of all the Native American fascists. And his allies included anti-Semites, Gerald Winrod and Elizabeth Dilling, Henry Ford's general secretary, Ernest Liebold, who was said to have his own Gestapo within the Ford Motor Company. Smith himself was employed by Ford, rooting out communists and labor unions, and among his personal papers are elaborate documents and lists giving the daily whereabouts of factory workers and suspected communists.
So you can see how those in the United States, the American fascism in the state of the United States, evolved into this McCarthyism, anti-communist, anti-liberalism in a way. Unions are all bad and that kind of thing. You mentioned earlier that a neo-Nazi rise came in the 60s, and it's definitely shown in the 1970s with the March in Detroit, and even in a way the Blues Brothers movie made comments about Illinois Nazis. You know, they were there, they were here. So do you still see that they never really went away, and that we have this underpinning of American fascism that kind of lurks around and just didn't dissolve?
Well, I think as long as we have a KKK, we have them. But at different times, they were more on the fringe than they were before. So I do say that ever since there was such a thing as Nazism in the 30s, that they have existed here. But at different times, the world events caused them to come out of the woodwork. And I think we might be in that moment now. Not to the same extent as what I'm writing about. I think that the period I'm writing about, they were more in the mainstream than they ever were before or have been since. But unfortunately, right now, not to get political, but we have a major party and a major political office sometimes defending them. That has never happened that I can see. So they operated very much outside of the political establishment. And despite, you know, Smith's multiple runs for senator and president, he never gained power. Mm-hmm. He was just someone to listen to and, you know, vent anger with.
Right.
But now it's a bit of a scarier time. And not just here, but around the world.
Thank you so much for being on our podcast. I learned a lot. I shared your article with my kids. I don't know if they read it, but, you know, it's in their hands somewhere because I thought it timely, informative, and gave us a glimpse of what America is going through. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Tales from the Reuther Library is a production of the Walter P. Reuther Library of Labor and Urban Affairs at Wayne State University, coming to you from the heart of the Cultural Center of Detroit, Michigan. The producers of Tales from the Reuther Library are Dan Glogner and Troy Eller English. Special assistants from the Reuther Podcast Collective, including Bart Bilmer, Elizabeth Clemens, Megan Courtney, and Paul Nierink. Of course, this podcast cannot be done without the research and the support of the entire Reuther Library staff. To learn more about the Reuther Library, or if you have any questions, please visit our website at www.reuther.wayne.edu. Thanks for listening. Say goodbye, Dan.
Goodbye, Dan. He warned us that there were powerful groups with lots of money, put money into power of people and put people, general people, less. Let me start that over. Okay, Troy? I'm sorry.
Okay.
She talks about this anti-Semitic writings of Henry Ford and how his writing influenced Hitler in the end of... And I did not do well in this. I thought I did a very good job. Never mind. You know, half the time she's going like, I didn't sign up for this crap.
I'm not getting paid enough for this.
Exactly.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day that Paul Robeson received the Spingarn Medal from the NAACP. The award was given annually to the African American with the highest achievement. Robeson certainly fit that criteria. He was born in Princeton, New Jersey. He attended Rutgers University, where he was an athletic standout and valedictorian. He earned his law degree from Columbia. He was a successful singer as well as stage and film actor. He was also an internationally recognized star, with singing engagements all around the world. Robeson strongly supported labor and working people. He was also an outspoken critic of U.S. colonialism. His stand for social justice made him a target of Senator Joe McCarthy during the hysteria of the Cold War Red Scare. Because of his alleged communist ties, in 1950, Robeson's passport was revoked. It took him 8 years to get it reissued. During that time, he could not travel abroad to perform. The International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers invited Robeson to sing at their Canadian convention in 1952. Since he could not travel, he sang over the telephone. The union then organized a concert on the Washington State-Canadian border. Standing on a flatbed truck parked on the U.S. side of the border, Robeson gave a 45-minute performance to a crowd of 40,000 people. He started the concert by saying, quote, "I stand here today under great stress because I dare, as do you, all of you, to fight for peace and for a decent life for all men, women, and children." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free?
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. And even better, you can like it there. Pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Our music today included Paul Robeson singing Joe Hill and One More Day from Elaine Perkey. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 70 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
One day more, if the company holds out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more. One day more, one day more. People, let me tell you what we're fighting for. We're fighting for your future, don't you understand? And you won't need our pity, you'll just need our helping hands to fight one day more, one day more. If the companies hold out 20 years, we can hold out one day more. If the companies hold out 20 years, we'll hold out one day more.